Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Today, we're going to have a great show for you, one I've been looking forward to. Our guest is Sundiata Chajuwa, professor of African American Studies here at the University of Illinois, a colleague of mine at the university, and we're having him for the whole hour.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. The NATO summit opens this afternoon in Chicago. A major issue is expected to be the future of Afghanistan, now that foreign troops are departing that country. Most NATO troops are scheduled to leave Afghanistan by the end of 2014. NATO members must now consider how they'll pay to train Afghan forces to take responsibility for their own security. Security is tight in Chicago for the meeting. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports police and protesters are gearing up for a major demonstration.
Anti-NATO activists have been planning this rally for months, and thousands have come to Chicago to protest the war in Afghanistan and the expansion of the NATO alliance. There have already been a number of both planned and spontaneous protests held. Mark Kaplan, who demonstrated in front of Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel's home, says the protest here might not change the international priorities of the NATO summit, but they do make a difference.
It does make a difference. It makes a difference to people around the world to see that there are people in Chicago and people in America that, you know, that agree that the priorities of the world need to be changed around towards fairness.
At today's rally, veterans also plan to ceremoniously return their service medals to NATO. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
Abdel Basset Ali Amegrahi has died at the age of 60. He's the only person convicted of the 1988 Lockerbie bombing. NPR's Asma Khalid reports.
In 2001, Al-Megrahi was convicted for the 1988 bombing of a Pan Am flight that killed 270 people over Lockerbie, Scotland. The former Libyan intelligence officer was held in prison in Scotland until 2009. Then, in a highly controversial decision, UK officials released him on humanitarian grounds. Al-Megrahi was diagnosed with cancer, and doctors at the time said he had only months to live. He was allowed to return to Libya. Al-Megrahi died in his home in the Libyan capital Tripoli after a long battle against prostate cancer. To the end, he claimed he was innocent. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Security sources in Lebanon say Lebanese soldiers shot and killed two Syrians today, including a Sunni cleric in the northern part of the country. The sources say the two men were killed in their car as they tried to speed through a police checkpoint without stopping. The army confirms two men were shot but did not give details. The violence in Syria has spilled into sectarian unrest in neighboring Lebanon in recent days. House Speaker John Boehner says the billion-dollar losses at J.P. Morgan haven't made his change his mind about banking regulation. The 2010 law known as Dodd-Frank bans companies from making speculative investments, but it has an exception for trades done to hedge risk. Boehner told ABC's This Week, more regulation wouldn't have made a difference in this case.
I don't believe there's anything in Dodd-Frank that would have prevented this activity at J.P. Morgan.
Boehner said there's no law against stupidity, no law against stupid trades. This is NPR News. A powerful earthquake struck northern Italy this morning. Officials say four people were killed and dozens were injured. The U.S. Geological Survey put the quake's magnitude at 6, making it the strongest to hit Italy in 3 years. The quake seriously damaged several old churches and other historic buildings, including a medieval castle. It was followed by a series of aftershocks, one with a magnitude of 5.1. Later today, people in the western United States will be treated to a partial eclipse of the sun. In some places, the sun will appear as a ring when the moon gets between the Earth and the sun. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
There's no total eclipse this time around, but up to 97% of the sun will be covered by the moon during this celestial event. People in a broad zone that includes Redding, California, Reno, Albuquerque, and Lubbock, Texas, will be able to watch as the moon creates a black circle in the middle of the sun. There will still be a bright ring of light peeking out from around the moon. This so-called annular eclipse will last a few minutes in some places. People farther afield in the west can still see a partial eclipse. You can damage your eyes by looking directly at the sun during an eclipse, but you can buy special glasses or create your own pinhole projector to watch. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The National Hurricane Center is reporting the first Atlantic tropical storm of the season, even though hurricane season doesn't officially begin until June 1st. Meteorologists say Tropical Storm Alberto is churning in the Atlantic, about 90 miles from Charleston, South Carolina. It's not expected to make landfall, but could produce high winds, heavy surf, and scattered rain across the region. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Valvoline, maker of Next Gen Motor Oil. Engine protection with oil made from 50% recycled stock. Learn more at Valvoline.com.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Today, we're going to have a great show. Our guest is Sundiata Chajua, professor of African American Studies here at the University of Illinois. And we're having him for the whole hour here live in the studio, live for us in the studio, recorded, I must say, for you. So please don't call in. We're recording this show, five weeks before going on air. Sundiata, welcome to Media Matters.
Glad to be here again, Bob.
Well, there's so much to talk about in terms of politics and African-American experience that I want to get to with you. You're one of the best scholars of African-American history in the United States. You're the president of the Association of...
National Council for Black Studies.
National Council for Black Studies, going into maybe your second term, finishing your first.
Running unopposed.
Well, we don't have to. Yeah, you're just so formidable. I guess the Koch brothers threw their support behind you, so you got all the bets.
I have my own super pack.
Your own super pack. There we are. And, you know, there's so much ground I want to cover about contemporary politics, but your research has been primarily in the 19th century, a lot of it at least.
Yeah,
your book on Brooklyn, Illinois. Yeah. Which is from the 1820s till the early 20th century?
Yeah, to about 1915.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, and then your more recent research has been on the period, really at the late 19th century that you and I have talked about.
Yeah, I've kind of moved between what Rayford Logan called the nadir, mm-hmm. from about the late 1870s through the 1920s. And then I also do stuff on the post-1960s period, but yes. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about that first period, first of all, because the nadir and immediately thereafter. What is it about that period that is so important for understanding American history and the African-American experience? What took place then? Because let me phrase that by saying, with my students, oftentimes, there was slavery, and then there was the Civil Rights Movement, and then now we're in where we are today. And there's sort of very little discussion of 1865 to 19 till Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King. And you have clearly zeroed in on that as being a very decisive period.
You know, what's interesting is that a number of African-American scholars argue that this is the most decisive period. Some people refer to it as the moment in which African-Americans are molded into a nation.
The late 19th century.
The late 19th century, right? Because we're talking about that generation of people who are freed by the Civil War and their children. And so in one sense, if we use the nation metaphor, right, the idea that African-American people constitute a nation within a nation, though I guess we could say a nation within a multiracial or multinational state, this is a moment in which you see the formation of national black institutions, particularly secular institutions, right? You get the proliferation of lodges, you get political social organizations, and in that sense, you get a network of African-American leadership. You also get the creation of, you know, these institutions, schools, etc. And in addition, I would argue that this is the moment where you see a real flourishing of African-American culture. So if you think about just if we take music, right, this is the moment in which gospel, the blues, ragtime, jazz are created and molded.
1880 to 1910.
Right. So this moment is absolutely key for the formation of black social institutions in African-American culture, and it creates the kind of national networks that they're embryonic, right? Obviously, they develop much greater later, but that base is laid in this period. And even in terms of African-American efforts at black capitalism, this is the high moment for a number of black banks. It's a high moment for African-American insurance companies.
Nationwide,
largely in the South. But Chicago has always been a hotbed for African-American business, right? In fact, a curious fact, 1910, 110 black hospitals in the country. 2011.
How many?
Yeah,
zero.
Right.
Four.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, newspapers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, thousands.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's a. So this is a very important moment in the development of African-American political thought. A number of other things. So yes, but it's also the moment that I would argue is most like the period that we're living in now in these kinds of ways, right? One, you have an intense anti-black hysteria sweeping the country. River Logan used the term contempt. And if you're paying any attention at all, right, clearly there's deep-seated contempt for African-American life at this particular moment, right? If we look at the waves of immigration, that's also a period in which, you get waves of immigrants largely from Asia coming into, the labor migrations, people being brought in to perform the dirty tasks of capitalist labor. It's also a moment in which you get a nationalization of police forces. In some sense, the forerunner to the FBI is created. Mm-hmm. There's a vicious attack on American labor, on and on and on. And you get the restructuring of capital. Capital moves from a kind of dynastic to a monopoly form, the internationalization mm-hmm. in terms of U.S. imperialism. So these are very similar moments. And this is a period, it's in this cauldron that of a transforming capitalism and a vicious anti-black racism, but also racism against other groups, that the African-American national group is molded.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I recently watched the PBS documentary, Slavery by Another Man. One of the points it made, and I wanted to get your feedback on this, is that the sort of white supremacy we have in America today with the racist image of African-Americans, the argument of that show was that that really comes out of this era, not out of the pre-1865 era, that the sort of the racist notions about African Americans today, really, that's their birth point is in the 1870s, 80s, 90s.
Well,
I want your take on it.
I saw that, too. And I think
it was interesting at the time.
Yeah. I think that they lost a little complexity. And what they probably meant to suggest is that this period is where it deepens and it moves out of the slave form, which to some degree is, the plantations and tied to that form, to a more national, generalized form. And I think in that sense, they're correct. And the image changes. One of the things I try and do in this class that I teach, well, actually, all of the history courses that I teach, is get students to focus on two big concepts, right? To think about structure in terms of institutionalized racism and to think about representation in terms of racial stereotypes. And so if you take the moment that we're talking about, right, what's important is that in the slave period, the representation of African Americans reflected the generalized needs of that political economy. So in that moment, you're not going to describe black men as brutes, right? You're not going to engage in mass murder, genocidal practices, i.e. lynching.
Against your property.
Race riots against your property,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So the image of blacks in that moment, you've got the Uncle Tom, which is subservient. You've got the Zip Coon as a buffoon, but mm-hmm. subservient. And you've got the mammy figure. Mm-hmm. When you move into emancipation and the sharecropping regime, the plantation economy, black people are no longer held as property. That's their life is no longer valuable to whites, right? It's a moment where blacks have achieved, at least on paper, level of civil rights through the Reconstruction Acts. And so at that moment, blacks are contesting for political power because they represent, more than a third of the population of the South, the majority in South Carolina, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And then so it's the image of the brute, the racist, mm-hmm. the racist. And it's about killing and maiming. And so the nature of that period in terms of its violence, mm-hmm. right, the number of race riots in that period, at least 3,000 people that we can document lynched, that period does cement and does take on a characteristic that one could argue was worse than the moment of slavery. Hence, Rayford Logan's concept of the nadir, that it is the abyss, it is the lowest moment in the African struggle for freedom on the North American continent.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Cindy Adachajewa, professor of African American Studies here at the University of Illinois, a colleague of mine. It's a pleasure to have him here. It is a pre-recorded show. We taped this 6 weeks, I think, before we went here, 5 or 6 weeks. So please don't call in. Sit back, relax, enjoy it. We're talking about American history, and we're soon to talk about American contemporary politics, the African American experience in particular, but really all politics for that matter. And let's bring it ahead if we can.
Okay.
And you have been – well, one last thing I want to ask you about, and I've never asked you this. This is off the top of my head because I want to later on talk about Malcolm X, who you've done a lot of work on, and Martin Luther King and where they're at in history. But I'd like to go back and talk about one of the figures who really emerged early in the century as a dominant figure, W.E.B. Du Bois.
Right.
And he's a name I think a lot of our listeners have heard of. I doubt many people have had a chance to read his books or work. But can you just talk a little about who he was and what his contribution is?
Well, he's the first African-American to receive a Ph.D., born in the Northeast, and to some extent, his outlook is molded there. But as a college student, because of the nature of racial apartheid, he went south to Fisk University.
This is in the 1880s?
This is in the early 1880s.
Okay.
Early 1880s. Late 1880s. Du Bois... he publishes his first book on the suppression of the slave trade. So it becomes literally the first scientific history of African American, right? He goes on to work in the fields of sociology. In fact, because he went to Germany and was trained in empirical sociology there, American sociology at that time tended to be more theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
So Du Bois comes back with real empirical methodologies that he puts into play in the Philadelphia Negro, a 1997 study. So in some sense, right, one could legitimately... Did I say
1897. Yeah,
wow.
That's our...
yeah.
So in some sense... I read that in high school. Can you believe that?
Really?
Yeah.
That's highly unusual.
Yeah, well, I was an unusual. I was an independent study.
Oh, okay, independent study. I didn't think it was
on
the course list, right?
Yeah.
Because I was gonna say when we would have been in high school, Du Bois was probably only just being brought back.
He was being brought back, and that's why I wanted to read him, because he was being. So this is like a main figure we should know about.
That's right, because he had been suppressed coming out of the anti-communist hysteria. Anyway, so Du Bois, in some sense, one could argue, is the quote-unquote father of American empirical sociology, right? We tend to think of him as a historian, but Du Bois wrote across all genres. He's got novels, poetry, fiction, and, of course, he's one of the founders of the NAACP, and in the 30s, he joins the USA Communist Party, goes to Ghana, leaves the country after experiencing, great harassment. So he ultimately dies in the first independent African country to come out of European colonialism, Ghana, in 1963. So Du Bois, in some sense, represents almost 100 years of African-American scholarship and activism.
Yeah, and seminal. Yeah, he was, I remember in the 60s, he was brought back, and he was like a central figure. There were W.E.B. Du Bois clubs. Do you remember those?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And they were subversive, as they say.
Yeah, that was their, I won't say anymore, I'll probably get in trouble. Let's talk a little bit about Malcolm X. Manning Marable wrote a major book on Malcolm that came out right as he died, regrettably, almost simultaneous with his death. And Manny Marable died at a young age. You knew him. I knew him. This was the crowning achievement in his view of his career, because he put lots of time into this work. And it's been before we talk about that book, though, let's just talk a little about Malcolm, because I think there's some listeners who've heard about him and there's sort of an image of him. Maybe they've seen the Spike Lee film. Maybe some have read the autobiography. But for those who haven't read or seen that, or who have but don't know the whole story, give a little more. Who was Malcolm? Why is he important?
This is interesting. My class lecture today was Malcolm.
Really? Well, good. Right. So you've got all the fresh material.
Yeah, I got it all fresh in my mind. Before I talk on Malcolm, I like to go back and listen to some of his speeches, because Malcolm, I would still argue, is the greatest American orator. Mm-hmm. Malcolm, the Malcolm that we know is an individual who remakes himself. And I guess that's the highlight of the story, is that his ability to transform himself. So we're talking about an individual that's born in the Midwest, Omaha, Nebraska. His parents are members of Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, which is probably the second largest African-American political organization in history, having somewhere near a million members, right? And they're dedicated activists. Malcolm's father is ultimately slain by a very violent offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan, a group called the Black Legion.
This is in the 20s?
This is in the 20s in Michigan. And so Malcolm's mother, the pressure.
The Garvey Group, before, just so listeners are familiar, what was their agenda? Was a back to Africa agenda?
That's probably their end game, mm-hmm. right? But they're more complex than that. Mm-hmm. So, for mm-hmm. example, they're engaged in different cities. They operate differently. So in Milwaukee, they work in a political alliance with the Socialist Party to elect mm-hmm. progressive candidates. In the South, you know, they organize against white capping and violent forms of terrorism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're probably most known for these dramatic marches and for the Black Star Line, their attempt to recreate commercial relations between Africans dispersed to the Caribbean, Africans in the U.S., Africans on the continent. Mm-hmm. But it would be fair to say that they are a bourgeois nationalist group that challenges white supremacy, but they have real limitations in okay. their interpretive framework.
Right? Okay, now back to Malcolm's mom.
Okay, so Malcolm's mother, the pressure of raising the children, extremely poor, and, you know, what happened to her husband and just the resentment of the folks around, she ultimately has a breakdown and is placed in a mental institution for the rest of her life. And Malcolm then moves through a series of foster homes, ultimately based on an incident that he has in school that kind of breaks his sense of hope, right? He ends up leaving school, dropping out in eighth grade, goes to Boston, becomes a petty thief, and while incarcerated.
And this is, he's still very young at all.
Oh, yeah.
That's what's
yeah,
incredible,
yeah.
the story. No, when you hear the story, you think he's like 35 by the time you get this stuff. He's like 19 or 20.
That's right. He's born in 25. He gets out of prison in 52.
Yeah.
So you see how young he is, and he spends 6 years in prison. But in prison for Malcolm was a time in which he's able to really get control of himself, right, and create a life mission. So in that period, he adopts the theology of the Nation of Islam, led by Elijah Muhammad, and you know, at rock bottom, the belief is that people of African descent are the original humans, what they call the Asiatic black man, and that Allah, God, would ultimately bring them back to power, right, and that God would destroy the white devils in their framework. Malcolm really builds that movement. I mean, it grows. I think there's 400 members when he's let out of prison, and I think he grows it to over 400,000.
And is he largely responsible, do you think, for that growth?
You know, obviously, it's a collective effort, but he would have to be the individual that you would say recruited the most members, had the national stage, was the most dynamic speaker, and had the greatest, the most innovative vision. So he creates the Muhammad Speaks newspaper, you know, so he's doing things to attract. He's put himself in a situation where he's able to debate the major civil rights leaders and white and black intellectuals at the major universities. Some of these things appear on TV, and he's a guy with an eighth grade education that wins all these debates, mm-hmm. right? Very charismatic and powerful. Mm-hmm. So, yes, despite what the Nation of Islam folk would say, yeah, Malcolm probably deserves as much of that credit as anyone.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, he runs into conflict in the nation. You know, what gets publicized is his finding out about the moral failings of Elijah Muhammad. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to diminish that aspect. And in the Marable book, Marable points out something that's rarely been mentioned, that one of the young women that Elijah Muhammad has a child with had been someone that Malcolm had been in love with during his teenage years. Mm. So that gives it a personal cast. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Now, clearly that's important, but I think probably more important, actually I'm certain more important are the political questions, that the nation, because Elijah has a millenarian philosophy, right? Nation of, they believe that Allah will take action. Therefore, they don't have to do anything to challenge white society. In fact, Nation of Islam, one of their basic rules was obey all American laws. Now, think about how conservative that is, because the basic premise of Martin Luther King, right, is disobey American law,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because it's segregation, it's racist,
yeah,
but apartheid. So interesting,
yeah,
that in that sense, the so-called integrationist was more militant and radical than the so-called nationalist.
Yeah, yeah.
So Malcolm ultimately, because of these political limitations and the moral failing, breaks with the nation. And when he breaks, again, it's another kind of revelation. And he, I don't like Mirabeau's term, reinvents. I'll say that he furthers his quest in terms of self-transformation, and this time toward a more revolutionary position. And in that regard, it's aided by both his engagement in civil rights type activity. He gets involved in rent strikes and those kinds of things. Also, his engagement with intellectually and personally with revolutionaries on the African continent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people make a lot about the Mecca piece. Well, you know, that's important, but the definitive piece is what's happening with him trying to influence the Organization of African Unity, which is the, it's like the European Union. It's the, an organization,
well, the
today
African
it's called
State.
The AU,
yeah.
The African Union. It's the heads of states of Africa who are trying to think in some ways about a pan-Africanist vision, how they can in fact unite or at a minimum cooperate. And Malcolm wants to get the AU to present a petition before the UN charging the United States with genocide. Basically, he's picking up what Du Bois and the NAACP tried to do in 1944, what the Civil Rights Congress tried to do in 1958. Okay. And it's...
And this is anathema to Elijah Muhammad, I assume.
I don't know that Elijah is as concerned about that, since Malcolm's out of the nation
at
the time.
At this point,
yeah. Malcolm's out.
It wouldn't have been something he would have been pushing.
No. To give you an example, 62, a group of Muslims are, at least one of them is shot and wounded, may have died, and several of them are beaten while they're just selling newspapers, Muhammad speaks, on a corner in L.A. And Malcolm goes out, and his initial effort is to think in terms of a military response, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he's convinced by an old communist, Cyril Briggs, actually, to think in terms of organizing an anti-police brutality campaign and to open it up to progressive whites, which Malcolm agrees to do. And initially, Elijah agrees to this. This is 1962.
That's really interesting.
Very interesting. And then Elijah changes his mind and shuts that activity down and says, he gives some kind of explanation about it'll go bad for the brothers in court if we engage in these kinds of protests. So he then opts for an NAACP-style legal defense as opposed to a more streetwise demonstration. So Malcolm, once freed of the conservatism, right, of the Nation of Islam, begins to embark and associate with people who are engaged in those activities. Now, he's, you know, he's still a nationalist, but he's been deeply influenced by people like Kwame Nkrumah, Ben Bella, and others, so that he's now thinking about an anti-capitalist position, and you see that very clearly in the writings. And, of course, the
assassination. And now we're like in 64, 65?
Yeah, we're talking 64, 65. Yeah,
and he's assassinated in 65.
In February of 65.
And so... what is his, as you talk to your students, what is the importance of Malcolm for students, for people today? Right. What should we know about Malcolm?
You know, the first thing I try and do is raise this question with them. Why is it that at three moments since 1965, the African-American community has, in effect, resurrected Malcolm? So that after his death, if you were to look at the number of poems, the number of books and articles written, there's more written on Malcolm than on Martin, and certainly by black scholars, right? There are more people who name their children after Malcolm, you know, they're either called Malcolm or Malik, than black people who name their children in honor of Martin Luther King. So from that standpoint, there's a deep love and affection. So then we can go to the hip-hop moment when Spike Lee's film comes out. But if you look at early rap, Malcolm is central. Like today I played this old 1993 song called Malcolm X, No Sellout. It's from Keith LeBlanc, who was part of the Boogie Down production with KRS-One.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, they're sampling speeches, and then they're saying, Malcolm X, no sellout, no sellout, no sellout. And the point is that the contemporary leaders of that period, they view as sellouts. And then we get to this moment where the Mirabeau book, within 2 months, There's 150 reviews of the book. It's number 3 on the New York Times bestseller. So the question I pose is, how do you account for this guy's continuing popularity, someone who was despised when he was dead? And so so then we try
to... When he was alive.
When he was alive, yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. So then since he's been dead, to try to remake him.
Yeah, yeah.
And capture him. So I try and get them to think in terms of what are Malcolm's contributions. So I would break it down into 4 things. And the big takeaway message is that he's a precursor to Black Power, and that you can get the basic ingredients of the Black Power ideologies out of Malcolm, right? But one of the significant things that Malcolm does is that he takes seriously the need to take the tactics that Martin Luther King is engaged in, direct action, mass civil disobedience, and merge them with a Black nationalist ideology. So in that sense, then he brings politics, or he repoliticizes Black nationalism in a mass scale. Mm-hmm. Malcolm makes armed self-defense a reasonable option. You know, he's such a skillful orator, and he can break it down in such a simple way that you're like, well, of course people have to be able to defend themselves. He really
because white people, there wouldn't be any question about it. Stand your
right,
ground.
Right. Yeah. Of course not. Of course not. And then, you know, you can go through a number of other kinds of things. Like, I would argue that Malcolm begins to formulate in the ballot or the bullet speech, he begins to think about how one can take power without necessarily having to rely on violence. And so he begins to talk about gaining control of Black communities politically, socially. And, you know, this stuff isn't thought out and it's not, you know, deep, but it has an impact so that when Stokely Carmichael and Charles V. Hamilton write Black Power, the very first thing they talk about is Black people gaining political control of the areas where they are the majority and proportional representation in areas where they are a minority. So I would say that those things kind of crystallize. And Malcolm begins to rethink sexism. And, you know, the point that I like to make is that we can't say what changes in the way in which he operates the home life, right? I don't know what happens there. But what we do know is that in the organization of Afro-American Unity that he creates, a large number of the leadership are women, mm-hmm. and particularly the people immediately below Malcolm are women.
Which at that time was very unusual,
right.
anywhere in the U.S.
You know, look, if you're comparing Martin Luther King to Malcolm X on the question of male chauvinism, Malcolm in his last year moves light years ahead of where King ever was if you look at how they function inside their organizations mm-hmm. in those last moments, right? So that's an important, gesture. We don't get to see it fully developed because he's assassinated, but it's an important gesture. Mm-hmm. And then I would say that there's a kind of generalized point that Malcolm demonstrates the capacity, no matter how horrific one's circumstances, for one to begin to rise above. And the motto, right, is study and struggle. That it's through his engagement inside the Nation of Islam, his day-to-day work, to build that organization, to go out and do what he called fishing, to go out and attract new members, the street corner oratory around the country, you know, to build that organization on a day-to-day basis. You know, Malcolm's working literally like a slave. He's working sun up to sundown mm-hmm. for the organization, completely dedicated. And then study, that Malcolm really immerses himself in learning about African-American history and culture, U.S. society. From the moment he's in prison, this is a guy with an eighth-grade formal education who would go on to successfully debate the leading thinkers of the country. And so that model of deep, serious study and combining that with real activism and engagement, you know, in building a mass-based organization, that that would be the takeaway message for me, that if you want to emulate Malcolm, get serious about the scholarship on who we are as a people, the nature of our oppression, what the current conjuncture is, and what we have to do to change it, and get yourself engaged in doing something in a very practical way.
Our guest, Cindy Adetajewa, professor of African-American Studies at the University of Illinois. This show we recorded about 5 weeks, so I think we've decided on now finally before going on air. So please don't call in. Sit back. Let us do the talking here at Media Matters. We've got about a half hour left or so, Cindy Adetajewa. And I want to come up to the present, but one last thing about this era that I'd be remiss not to ask. Martin Luther King, how, you know, your assessment of him, and sort of what's happened to him since his death.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. As a, you and I are the same age, Bob.
Yeah.
So we come up in the same period. So when I was a kid, I got involved. We did a school boycott my freshman year. And from then, I've just spun through various youth organizations and ultimately into adult political organizations, Black Power type organizations. And during that period, we respected Martin Luther King, but we thought of him primarily as a competitor, right? Meaning mm-hmm. that we were the children of H.R.A.P. Brown, Stokely Carmichael, and the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
And King, while we respected him, represented the wrong view.
A different way.
Yeah. No. We didn't just think
wrong
it was
way.
Different. We thought it
a
was wrong.
Wrong way.
Yeah, it's wrong. As I got involved in actually reading Martin Luther King, it's amazing how profoundly radical Martin Luther King was. But that moment, right, you have to kind of bifurcate King. If you read some of the stuff he wrote in the 50s shortly after the Montgomery bus boycott, you see that radicalism, his concern for you about U.S. imperialism, right,
mm-hmm.
his anti-colonialist perspective, his uneasiness with capitalism. But he has to suppress that stuff by the late 50s, right, into the, and that side of King doesn't reemerge until the until 1965 Chicago,
mm-hmm.
right, when he goes into Chicago in that fair housing battle,
yeah.
He has to reevaluate everything, and that reevaluation has to be premised socially in terms of movement wise. You've got the rebellions that are going on every summer from 64. Until his death. And so the masses of black people have clearly rejected much of King's ideology and perspective. And he's got to try and figure out how he can win back the masses. And the competition has morphed from what I would say was the NAACP, which represented a more retrograde view, mm-hmm. right? King's more progressive,
yeah.
engaging
yeah.
in activism, to groups that are more progressive than King, and mm-hmm. certainly more militant, meaning
yeah.
the Panthers, SNCC, yep. League of Black Revolutionaries, you know, just
yeah.
a plethora of groups. And King has to respond to Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael. He has to respond to their militants.
Mm-hmm.
And so his response is to, he has to respond to black power. So his response is to think deeply about American society as a whole. So in part, the response to black power is capitalism is oppressive of all people in America. So we need to build a rainbow coalition. Right, we need to build a mass movement of all of the American people to oppose this. And secondly, because he's got to deal with the question of, since he still believes in nonviolence, how do you make nonviolence militant and attracted to some 16-year-old kid like me, as mm-hmm. I was at that time, right? So King decides to push the more radical form. So he starts talking about, in terms of the campaign in Washington, D.C., of the Poor People's Campaign, he's talking about shutting down the operation of the U.S. government, shutting down the movement of whites back into Washington, D.C., because at night they'd go into Virginia, those suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about blocking the bridges with human bodies. He's talking about going down on the floor of Congress and stopping them from operating. He's talking about surrounding the Pentagon and stopping their activities. So he's now beginning to use nonviolence, as James Forman, the leader of SNCC, had argued, that King always used the passive form of
yeah,
civil disobedience.
Rather
right?
than like, stop stuff.
Yeah, he was using the passive form. So he said, now King is beginning to use the more assertive and militant form. And so in that sense, when you begin to read the King that lays out his critique of Vietnam War, because it's not just about peace, it's about opposing imperialism,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that King and Malcolm at the last year, right? King's last 3 years, Malcolm's last year and a half or so, they're moving, they're developing similar ideas. I'm not saying they're the same, but both are clearly anti-imperialist. King comes to understand some things about the African-American people that he had not focused on when he was deeply immersed in civil rights and a struggle for, that I guess one could say, structural integration. Like King, in his last book, Chaos Our Community, he talks about how he goes to a school, his daughter's class, and he comes to understand that there's nothing being taught in terms of African or African-American history, and he comes to see how debilitating that can be. And he talks about how he didn't understand the significance of African-American history and culture for young people to have a sense of, of self. And so that's something that he takes from the Black Power movement. So King is also making those kinds of adjustments so that if you take these two individuals at the end, they're much closer than they ever were in the bulk of their career. And I would argue that between them, we can't do much better than what the two of them leave us in terms of trying to chart
where they were at, where they were murdered.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you know, I might murdered. Add, just for listeners, Martin Luther King gave the talk at Riverside Church, I think, in April of 1967.
Actually, a year before he was assassinated.
And I would urge people to Google that. It's really one of the most extraordinary talks I've – it will change your view of Martin Luther King dramatically, depending on your politics for the better or the worse, but in my case, for the better.
And that's the problem is that Malcolm has been vilified by making him into this kind of madman. King has been vilified by essentially defaming him and freezing him in 1963 and not allowing us to see.
I got a great story for you before we go
on.
A friend of mine, a historian, back in, he lived in Madison for a while. His daughter was like 9 or 10 years old. He's white, but he does African American history. And she went to school and they were talking about Martin Luther King. And they were and she came home and said to her daddy, very confused look in her face. Daddy, was Martin Luther King black? So it's like the way they taught her, dude, like the guy's race was even, it was a deracinated Martin Luther King. Our guest today, Cindy Adachajua, we're talking about politics. Let's talk about today. I could talk forever about history, but let's get to the present. You know, one of the things that you talked about with with Malcolm in Los Angeles in 1962, that was one of the great issues of the 60s and 70s, which was community policing, which is this, you know, the history of police harassment and violence against African Americans is one of the, I think, one of the low points of American history. It's appalling. It hasn't gone away. But one of the great movements in the 60s and 70s of organizing was to try to strip away that sort of imperial power in the community, which could commit violence and be unaccounted for. And that sort of got totally blown away by this whole anti-drug SWAT unit militarization of police. Right. And it's left us to the situation we're in today. And, you know, maybe talk a little bit about the Trayvon Martin case, and we're recording this obviously just after Zimmerman's been arraigned. We have no idea what's happened by the time we're going on air. But, I mean, the importance of the case beyond Trayvon Martin was what it really represented in terms
absolutely.
Of the broad phenomenon in our society, which goes to a recurring theme in the African-American experience in America.
No, you hit it right there, Bob, that the extent to which what we'll call racialized violence has been used against African Americans with its origins in the period we talked about before in the Nadir and its continuation, that there was, as you say, in the 60s and said late 60s and 70s, a notion of pushing for community control of the police. And that's how we get to citizens review boards. Right. But what people were never able to achieve or were only able to achieve in a few locales was that there would be subpoena power. Right. And as you said, by the time we get into the late 80s, the intensity to create this drug war, that just wipes away even progressive black politicians like Maxine Waters signs on for Reagan's 1986 Drug Act. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it completely wipes that away. And here we are again with another major case. And it seems like every year there's a major case, and that case is always the tip of the iceberg. So we're talking about Trayvon Martin, and as you pointed out today, he was arrested, and he's going to be charged with second-degree murder. So, you know, there's some movement there. But if we peel back, we will find that in addition to the Trayvon Martin case, there's the individual Chamberlain in White Plains, New Jersey, the 68-year-old man who accidentally hit his little monitor. The police take off his door, tase him. Then they turn the cameras off, and then the guy is shot twice and dies, right? And the interesting thing is that they record him when they're taking down his door so that they can get in. They record him saying, I am such and such Chamberlain. I'm 68 years old, a former Marine. The police are going to come in here and kill me. Right. He understood that that's what they were going to do. And they were supposed to be coming to help him. And he's saying, I'm fine. It was an accident. I don't need any help. Right. And there's the Anna Brown woman in St. Louis, the homeless woman who had a twisted ankle or something was wrong with her, went to the hospital. They wouldn't provide her service, so they shipped her around. And ultimately, the police take her and throw her in jail, and she dies in police custody mysteriously. I mean, there's like 78. There's the guy in Mississippi that's run over by the white teenagers in the truck. And there's, what, four or five of them in the truck? And there's six or seven of them that beat him. And they only charge one person with murder, right? When normally, like, in terms of what happens to black youth, right, if you're with someone and they commit a crime and someone gets killed in the commission of that crime, even if it's the perpetrator, mm-hmm. and you're with them, you're charged with murder.
Yeah.
Right? But in this case, only the one person. So this thing is deep. And unless you're black or have black relatives or you're Latino, and even for Latinos, it's nowhere near the mm-hmm. intensity. It's hard to understand that, you know, there's just a deep-seated, profound distrust of the police. I mean, I fundamentally don't trust them.
We've talked about this off-air, the book that a new Jim Crow, which is to my absolute delight, after being on the show, it became a bestseller.
Yes.
Sold 180,000 copies, which I think just shocked everyone. But, I mean, it has the statistics in there on drug arrests
right.
in America. And I don't think it's possible to read this book and not think the drug war is completely bogus. Because, you know, you've got in Illinois, for example, and I'm doing this off the top of my head,
right.
Statistics show that African-Americans and whites and Latinos all use recreational drugs at roughly the same rate.
That's right, about 13% for
but
all
the,
groups.
But the arrest and incarceration is something like 80 to 90% African-American.
Right.
It's, you know, it's just, it's indefensible.
No, right.
There's
completely
no reason for it.
But here's the point, right? That book's a bestseller. And so one would think that the large number of people reading that there would be some kind of response, right? I was at a meeting at a local labor union where Senator Durbin was speaking. And so I asked him, you know, the question about, you know, the drug, when are you guys going to get rid of these drug laws? Because this is what's spurring incarceration and thus then no jobs because people have felony convictions,
yeah.
so they can't get jobs, on and on and on. And he tells me this story about how they fought to get the difference between crack cocaine and cocaine, the disparities. It used to be 100 to 1, and I think he tells me that they got it down to, I don't know, 30 to 1. And somehow that's supposed to be a victory for the Democratic liberals.
I think that's missing the point.
Right,
absolutely.
Completely. So on this point, I think what's missing is this. Every time one of these incidents achieves national recognition, it's always discussed in a vacuum. And it's always discussed on a one-to-one basis. We're caught up in the minutiae
yeah.
of who was on top during the fight.
Yeah, exactly.
And what we need to do is pull back and talk about the social structure, right? How is it that we can account for a social structure that goes back into the 1870s, right? That leads to mass incarceration of black folk, convict lease, and a cheapness to African-American life. The question isn't who kills a black person. The question is that the black person that's killed, their life is of no value. So it doesn't matter the race of the murderer. There will be very few convictions on and on because black life is held cheap. So why is it in American society that black life is held cheaply? Why is it in American society that the nature of policing lends itself to the over-policing of black communities, yet they don't stop crime?
Yeah.
Right? They don't stop crying.
No, not at all.
But they arrest people. So once we put it in the nature of the structure, I mean, we have to go back. And I think the Panthers had it right. Right? It's an army of occupation. And it's an army of occupation whose primary mission is to protect the property of elites. And once you grasp it at that level, then you understand that all of these laws that are emerging that are designed to keep black people out of public spaces, right? All of the anti-gang legislation, all of that stuff, then we understand this stuff as endemic to the social structure of the United States, that this is part of American capitalism. And if we think about it in those structural terms, then we can seek structural solutions. But as long as we want to individualize each instance and get caught up in that minutia and refuse to face the fact that American society has organized itself to be anti-black, right? That's the nature of the society, and it's conscious. It's not unconscious.
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about, in the waning 10 minutes or so of the program, Cindy Otto, let's talk a little bit about contemporary politics and this very issue. You know, the Democratic Party, obviously, President Obama is African American, and that's a historic accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And but I mean, aside from that, I mean, what has been your sense of Obama the president? Has he pursued an agenda that you think has reflected the African American experience and really sort of said, okay, I'm in power and I'm going to really go out there and push something?
You know, clearly not, Bob. I think we've talked.
That's what
before.
We call a rhetorical question.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's if I said I was disappointed, then that would mean that I had high hopes,
yeah.
Right? So I don't think I had high hopes. I did think that he would do better, but I thought that he would do better by pursuing a kind of universalist agenda. I never expected Obama to deal directly with the racial oppression that black people face. But I thought that he would follow a Franklin Delano Roosevelt scheme. Raise the boat level and push a real universalism within that that would, in fact, bring some relief to African Americans. His failure to do that has been deeply problematic. The other thing is that, well, we all know, you know, the jokes about Obama's willingness to compromise. You know that he compromises before the issue is put on the table.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, after he made some initial gestures around race, right? So one would be that ill-conceived quote unquote beer summit around Henry Louis Gates,
mm-hmm.
But also. The Attorney General Holder's came out and talked about American historical amnesia and intellectual cowardice on the question of race, and they got the back flack from the right and from liberals.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And then Obama just took any attempt to deal straight up with race off the table. When I would argue that he actually was well situated and could have framed a discussion that could have been driven by the research that would have put some things on the table and that he could have at least done the kind of things that Bill Clinton did in terms of a national conversation. It wouldn't have been the conversation you and I would want, but it would at least make the American people much more aware of the systematic ways in which the society is blatantly unfair.
Let me the current state of the Republican Party, which is one of the two parties, you know, you're giggling already, but probably – you know, not because it's especially funny, but rather frightening. I mean, where do you, I must say I was surprised a little bit by just some of the, like Rick Santorum, a couple of his comments that no one really commented on, but just blatantly racist comments he made that just passed by. I can imagine no other ethnic group except Arabs, I'll take it, that you can make that about in our society and just sort of sail by. Yeah. And I mean, what? It's almost surreal that we have the it's a party that seems to have virtually no people of color in it, or certainly no African Americans, and it's making little pretense that it has any interest in having them.
You know, I would again go back to history and say that, you know, one of the things that happened with Reconstruction is that it did bring some blacks to political power and representation, and so the response to that white backlash was just a rage of terror throughout the South in that period. And Obama's election...
And you're not using that word loosely, so listeners
know
that.
No. Absolutely.
Literally.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, if you read the testimony before the Joint Committee of Congress in the 1870s, right, because Congress ends up passing two acts, the Enforcement Act of 1870 and the Enforcement Act of 1871 that outlaw the use of intimidation, murder, etc., to prevent people from exercising their civil rights. Because it's so massive, the number of black folks that are murdered during this period, right? Well, in the contemporary moment, we're witnessing a white backlash to Obama's election that people naively thought that the election of Obama was saying something about the state of race relations in America, when it was actually saying something about the insufficiency, the inadequacy of the Republican candidates at that moment, right? Much of this virulence that's being fueled toward African Americans in this moment, structurally, it has something to do with the deep recession, right? But Obama has emerged as the target because people are reading Barack Obama as truly representative of the constituency that elected him. The constituency that elects him is 96% African American. It's in the high 80s for Latinos. It's in the high 60s, almost 70% of Asians. And for Asians and Latinos, they had never voted for Democrats at that level.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the image is that Obama represents America as a majority, minority society.
Pat Buchanan's worst nightmare.
Yeah. That, and so they don't understand Obama is not nearly as progressive as his constituency.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's become the target that allows this virulence to come out in such a way. And I would explain the Trayvon Martin piece as connected to this need to suppress black people because they believe that this is the last moment before these racial minorities become a majority. And with the deep economic problems in this society, right? I mean, look, working people, middle class people have been smashed for the last 30, 35 years, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Things decline. The housing crisis may actually be worse now than it was in 06, right?
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are now coming out, but people down on the ground are feeling this stuff, and they don't know how to move. And right-wing talk radio and Fox, for the typical average white person in this society, that's who they have access to. I was on a plane with some old white farmer, and I was thinking, you know, boy, this is going to be a long trip. Right? But we ended up having a good conversation, and mm-hmm. he pointed out to me that if you're in these small rural counties and you're in your, whatever it is, combine or...
listen to your radio.
Listen to your radio. The only, your only options are Russ Limbaugh or someone like Russ Limbaugh.
I drive a lot in Illinois, as you know, and it's astonishing to me. I mean, it is. You would think if you came from another planet that this country was 97% extreme right wing, that's the mainstream. You know, but on that issue, though, one of the things that's interesting to me, we've talked about this, too, is young people across races in this country. I've noticed, and I don't want to romanticize this because I don't think young people are especially political. I don't think – I'm not trying to say this is a – you know, they're storming the gates of the Bastille or anything. But the degree of sort of built-in racism that I think even my generation inherited because it's such a heavy burden of our historical legacy, it seems less to me today. The racist appeals don't resonate the same way they did 30 years ago, I would say. I mean, that's a hopeful sign for me.
And I think that the key is in the last phrase – like they did 30 years ago.
That's right.
But they still register. They register differently.
Yeah.
Like, I would argue that from my 25, 26 years of teaching on a Research One institutions, that white youth have become more racist in ways that matter, but they're not as unwilling to interact
mm-hmm.
with blacks.
Mm-hmm.
But their broad view of the world, right, is that black people are, by and large, lazy, not as intelligent as white people, and desire things to be given to them rather than for them to earn it.
Yeah.
And I would argue that they are much more strident on those views than the generation that you and I represent because... You know, you've only had moments of progressive generations on race, right? The 1930s is a moment,
mm-hmm.
and the 60s, 70s is a moment.
Yeah.
And these kids, what they are is they're comfortable in the presence.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And maybe I shouldn't be so optimistic as I try to be, but I'll keep struggling. Cindy Adachajawa, it looks like we're running out of time. This is a very fast hour, my friend.
Yeah, it truly is.
And we just, you know... I got about one-third of my list here of all the stuff I wanted to ask you about. We'll have to have you back again
soon. That's my fault.
No, this is, I learned a lot. It was great. I'm Bob McChesney. This has been Media Matters. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for engineering today's episode for us. Cindy Adachajawa, Professor of African American Studies at the University of Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob.
All right. Bye-bye, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Mostly sunny skies and warm today in Champaign-Urbana. A chance of showers, the high around 90 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy. A chance of rain, the low 62. Cooler and partly sunny tomorrow. A chance of morning showers, the high 72 degrees. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night, the low 55. Tuesday, partly cloudy, the high 72 degrees, the low 55. Mostly sunny Wednesday, the high 78. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.